Everyone, this is your one and only personal astrophysicist Rohit Agrawal right there, bringing a brand new episode for our podcast Astrophysics. So today we are going to start a new season, and as I have already released the trailer for the season, this season is dedicated to stars, and stars are, you know, probably the one of the most fascinating things out there in the night sky. And we'll start, and as the tagline says, that we'll study stars from their formation to death. So as you must have already guessed, we will start with the formation of stars. And today we have with us a brilliant PhD student, Molly Wells from UK. And she's doing a PhD in star formation. Hello.
Thank you. Nice to be on the podcast.
Yeah. Without wasting much of your time, let us get started, and we'll be asking some of the questions to Molly, and she'll be answering them, I hope.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about your research in this field of star formation?
Yeah, sure. So I started in research in my second year of my degree. In the summer, I wanted something to do as I was staying in the city where my university is. So I spoke to one of my lecturers who specializes in radio astronomy, and he gave me a project to do over the summer, like a short research project. And I looked into the statistical lifetimes of high mass stars in particular. And that entailed looking at how long stars spend in each stage of their life, so as they evolve through. And that was really fun, really enjoyed that. And then I did my master's thesis this year, which I continued on in the same field, specializing in star formation, high mass stars, because I really enjoyed it. And this year I did working on some of the foundations that I had done in my project before. I looked at collapse times of stars, and so how long it takes for a star to collapse and then evolve into, you know, it being on the main sequence, it being a fully fledged star in the middle of its life. And also the star formation efficiency of the galaxy as a whole, which star formation efficiency is essentially how much mass in the galaxy gets turned into stars, like as a percentage. So I've looked at a couple different things around star formation and particularly high mass stars. And I'm very excited to do my PhD, which is also going to be in star formation. I kind of got thrown in at the deep end a little bit, just doing a research project, finding out this is a field that I like, kind of lucky that it was the field that I first looked into. It's been really great, and I'm excited to do more research about star formation.
So that was pretty cool, and your research, I hope, is going good and it'll go good in the future. And it was really interesting. So let us start with our, today's topic of star formation. So let us start by having an overview of star formation. Can you give us a run through of the main stages?
Yeah, sure. So I'll start with talking just a little bit about properties of stars that we typically measure. So obviously stars vary in size, mass, temperature, all of these different things. If we talk in perspective of looking at comparing to our sun, we can have, in terms of size, you can have diameters ranging from 450 times smaller to over 1,000 times larger than our sun. Masses can range from 0.1 times or even lower the solar mass, up to 50 solar masses, 100 solar masses, so much larger. And surface temperature also has a very large range. Context in the middle. So our star is about 5,000 to 5,500 degrees Kelvin, and then Color is also linked to temperature, so our sun appears yellow, and the hottest stars are blue, with the coolest stars being red. And the energy produced by these stars is from nuclear fusion in the core, and this is linked to its brightness, and we measure brightness with magnitude. The brighter the star, the lower the magnitude on the scale, which, if you're not an astrophysicist, can mess with your brain a little bit, but it takes some getting used to. But there's two ways we measure brightness of star. We do apparent magnitude, which is the brightness as we see from Earth, just measured standardly, and then the absolute magnitude, which is the brightness of a star if we brought it to 10 parsecs away from us. That's just so we can compare brightnesses of stars to one another at a standard distance. So the formation of stars depends a lot on their mass. It's a big factor. So low mass stars and high mass stars form slightly differently, but they all go through some stages that are common in the beginning. So firstly, stars will be born in a region of a high density, where this condenses, the gas condenses into a huge globule as such, and then the dust and all of that stuff contracts under its own self-gravity. And then this region of matter will begin to heat up and start forming protostars, and the central temperature will just keep increasing until nuclear reactions, where hydrogen can fuse to form helium, until they can start, and the star begins to release energy, stopping it from contracting even more, and it will start to shine, and it's now on the main sequence. So that's pretty standard, and then this is where it splits into low mass versus high mass formation. So for low mass stars, let's talk in terms of just one like our sun. This will remain in the main sequence for, I don't know, maybe 10 billion years, until all the hydrogen has fused to form helium. At this point, the helium core now starts to contract further, more reactions begin to occur, and the core is now hot enough for helium to fuse, form carbon, and the outer layers begin to expand, cool, and shine less brightly, I guess. So this stage is now a red giant. The helium core then runs out, and the outer layers drift away from the core, as a shell almost, and the gas that surrounds this core is now a planetary nebula, and the remaining core, which is maybe 80% of the original star, is now in its final stages, which becomes a white dwarf, and until it eventually cools and dims, stops shining, which will then be a black dwarf. Now, for high-mass stars, slightly differently. High-mass stars evolve similarly until they reach the main sequence, however, and again, it will shine until hydrogen has fused to form helium. But this is a much shorter process, so it takes only millions of years in a massive star. And then after that, the massive star then becomes a red supergiant, starts off with a helium core surrounded by a shell of expanding gas, and before a series of nuclear reactions occur, forming different elements around an iron core. And then the core collapses in less than a second, causing an explosion called a supernova, in which a shockwave blows out the outer layers of the star. And sometimes, if the core survives the explosion, depending on its mass, if it's between maybe 1.5 to 3 solar masses, it can contract and become a very tiny, dense neutron star. But if the core is much greater than 3 solar masses, then it will contract and become a black hole. So that's kind of an overview. There's obviously some deviations. That's just standard high mass and low mass. But it's pretty interesting. There's a lot of different... I find it interesting how it depends so heavily on mass, what the star evolves into, you know, how its life is pans out. So, yeah, I hope that was a good overview for you.
Interesting indeed. And that was really, you know, amazing to know such thing, because that was the first time most of our listeners might be knowing. And, you know, star formation is a part of astrophysics. And why is star formation such an important part of astrophysics? So, yeah.
That's a good question. There's a lot of different parts of astrophysics. And this, I mean, this is the only part I've researched into in any depth. So other people might have other opinions as to which is the most important part of astrophysics. I don't think there's going to be one most important part of astrophysics. I think all these parts have their role to play. But star formation, it seems just fundamental. Before we start investigating into other things in our galaxy, if we can constrain and find out how stars form, evolve, predict what's going to happen to these new stars being born, then that's a pretty good grounding for astrophysics to then investigate, you know, the rest of the galaxy and the rest of what's going on in our universe. But particularly, in my opinion, massive stars play a very important role in a lot of astrophysical processes, because they form a lot of heavy elements, which is obviously very important. And they have a lot of influence and impact on their local environment through their outflows, stellar winds, radiation, but also on a galactic scale, because it's crucial for other astrophysical fields to understand the environment and conditions, and even processes involved in the birth and the earliest stages of massive stars due to the impact that they have. Which is why massive star formation is quite prominent at the moment, because the underlying physical processes involved in the formation of massive stars are very poorly constrained and defined at the moment, which, because they're very rare, we don't have a lot that we can look at. So this presents quite a major hurdle in understanding galaxy formation and evolution. So if we manage to constrain the formation and evolution of massive stars, then we can understand how galaxies form and evolve also, as, you know, massive stars and stars in general are quite an important part of galaxies. So basically, star formation is a baseline level of understanding other processes and other things in our galaxy, and then, you know, go on. We can understand our galaxy, we can understand other galaxies in the universe, and who knows, maybe the whole universe one day, but I think that's quite far off for now.
Yeah, sure. And as you said, that star formation actually gives us the basic idea, because, you know, stars are the primitive forms of black holes, if I'm correct. A star was once a black hole was once a star, right?
Yep.
And the same happens when white dwarf or with a neutron star. So all these heavy structures and, you know, massive structures, if I'm allowed to say the word, all these massive structures were once the part of star. So I do also think that a star formation is such an important part of astrophysics. So now, what are the limits of star formation from a point of view of Mars?
Yeah, that's a good question. Obviously, you know, there's going to be a limit to the mass a star can have. I looked at this recently in my master's thesis, and for the simulations and the work I was doing, I used a kind of standard range of 0.1 to 120 solar masses. Now, there are stars with less mass than that and much more mass than that. I think, don't quote me on this, but I've definitely read about 150 solar mass stars and maybe even larger. They're not common, but that happens. But the reason that I use this range in my research, and other people have also, is because in terms of mass, if we go much less than 0.1 solar masses, the core then can become degenerate before the temperature rises enough for fusion to begin. So then that's the definition of a star, you know, you have to have fusion. So if that can't begin, then that's the limit on stars. And larger than about 120, 150 solar masses, the stability and equilibrium of the star will start to be compromised. So it won't be able to accrete any more mass onto itself. So it physically won't be able to accumulate any more mass, which caps the upper limit of star formation. But there definitely is some exceptions to that. That's something I would like to read more about now that my degree's done. But yeah, that's a standard range from what I'm doing. And those are why I use those ranges. But there are exceptions, obviously.
Yeah. So I do think that there's a name to this limit, which is called Chandrasekhar limit, I guess.
That is more to do with black holes.
Okay.
The limit for this would, I guess it would be related to the Eddington luminosity, which is just the maximum luminosity almost a star can have, which luminosity is related to mass. So it kind of comes from that. But yeah, the Chandrasekhar limit is to do with black holes. So not quite applicable here, but it's also a very interesting one.
Yeah, obviously. That was to black hole, yeah. Now, I remember. So, what is the future for the field of star formation as you are, you know, the part of star formation? So,
yeah, so, I mean, I'd love to be able to give you a definite answer for this and tell you what we're going to discover and when. But, I think one of the most important things for this field will be to constrain the evolution of stars. So we know how they form, essentially high mass and low mass, and we know a lot about how they die and, you know, when they're fully formed, how the rest of their life plans out. But especially for high mass stars, we don't know that much about the in-between stage, the evolution. So if we figure that out, then star formation is going to be a very well-defined field. And then we can go on and use this in other parts of astrophysics. So the future for star formation, I hope, is to focus, I mean, I hope that I also am part of this, to focus on high mass stars, and their evolution, and so we can get a definitive, or as definitive as possible, timeline of how these stars go from each stage in their life to the next. Because that will allow us, if we have if we have a planned out evolutionary sequence that works, when we get new stars, we can, you know, and we look at young high mass stars, we can predict how their life is going to pan out, and that will allow us to see how that influences other things around. And again, all of this will help us understand galaxy formation and evolution and go on to bigger and crazier stuff in the universe, and maybe one day we'll know how it all works.
Again, that's interesting, and I've been saying this word quite a lot of times, so I'll be using another adjective now. So now, my last question, how do we observe stars for this research into their formation?
Yeah, so it's, I guess, classed as radio astronomy is how I got into it, which was actually a funny story. oh, maybe not funny, but I like it. It was a presentation I had to do in second year as part of my degree. We had to pick a topic and present it to a couple of other students, and we'd be assessed on our presentation skills. But I did mine on pulsars, which is radio astronomy. So that really got me interested in radio astronomy, which is then how I found my lecturer that was interested in radio astronomy and then did this project. So I guess it's that I have to thank. But yeah, so we observed stars for this research using infrared, submillimeter, and radio wavelengths. The telescope that collected the data that I used for my research is ALMA, which is a very up-and-coming telescope. They're doing lots more projects with data from ALMA. But in terms of low-mass and high-mass stars, observing low-mass stars is slightly easier. There's a lot more of them, and they have longer lifetimes. However, massive stars, they form in clusters, and due to their rarity, they are located at greater distances than some regions of low-mass star formation. And they evolve a lot more quickly than the low-mass stars. So it's kind of like a blink-and-you-miss-it situation. And they reach the main sequence while still very deeply embedded in their environment. So they're not as easy to look at. So we then need to use large areas to look at observationally. We need to search a lot more of the sky in order to identify a large number of sources, high mass stars, in each stage of their life. Whereas low mass stars, there's a lot of them, and we can look at a group of them, and they'll most likely be lots in different stages of their lives. But high mass stars, due to their rarity, if we only looked at a couple, we wouldn't have a whole picture of their evolution. So, yeah, we use radio, submillimeter, and infrared to look at this and take these pictures. And I've also done some classification, I guess is what I would call it. So I looked at images of these stars, and we had this criteria to classify them into different stages of their life. So we used quiescent, protostellar, young stellar object, and H2 regions, and it just depended on how they appeared at different wavelengths as to which classification they were in. But to do that, we needed 10,000 sources for high mass stars specifically, which is why to get enough in each evolutionary stage, whereas for low mass stars you could probably do that with a lot less stars. So yeah, radio telescopes I find really cool, and there's a lot of them around and being used. So yeah, hopefully the observations and the data we're going to get from this in the next couple of years, more projects from ALMA, more projects all over the world, will definitely help with star formation and help us know more about what's going on in the universe.
That was nice. And so kind of for the young listeners, would you like to say something for the life cycle and for their career in star formation or maybe astrophysics?
Sure. So I would say one thing that's really important is that you don't need to, if you change your mind and you want to go into astrophysics at 25, 30, 50, like, you can do it. It's not something that you need to start at a very young age to get into and be good at. If you're already interested, that's great. There's definitely lots online about stars. So yeah, get learning if you're interested in it. But I really like astrophysics, obviously. But I didn't know from a young age that this is what I wanted to do, especially not even a PhD. It was 2 years ago only I decided I wanted to do a PhD. So if you feel like that's what you want to do, obviously you need to get your undergrad degree, in a related subject, physics with astrophysics. It doesn't have to be a full astrophysics degree if you want to do a PhD in astrophysics. My degree was physics with astrophysics, so I only did a couple of modules in astrophysics, and I did, you know, every topic in physics, it felt like. So yeah, there's not too many restraints, so just, you know, do your degree if that's what you want to do, and if you find you want to do a PhD in, or well, any topic in physics I guess this relates to, go for it, because I don't think it matters what university you went to, what degree you have, if you're passionate, if you take the time, you read about it, you do these extra things, then you'll definitely find your place in the field. And yeah, I fully encourage it. I love stars. Fallen in love with them these past couple of years. So finding the part of astrophysics that you love is a dream. So yeah, I encourage it. And if anyone has any questions for me about my, I guess, path to where I am now, feel free to, you can message my Instagram, that astrophysicist mole, and I'll be happy to talk about it, because I'm just from a normal university in the UK, no very high up institution. I didn't get exceptional grades in my A levels. I've just found something I like and worked towards it, I guess. So yeah, if you have any questions, just let me know, but don't be discouraged, basically, is probably the best advice I can give.
Yeah, that was kind of inspiring. So now we sum up. I'd like you to sum up with the, you know, the conclusions that we can get out of the life cycles of stars. So just a very quick run through of a life cycle of star, how they are formed, what are the initial stages to their death?
So I obviously went into a bit more detail earlier, but obviously as an overview, stars, we're in a big molecular cloud. Stars collapse under their own gravity, and they start to undergo fusion, and then depending on the mass, they'll either fuse all of the hydrogen into helium, go into a red giant, and then into a white dwarf, before it cools down to a black dwarf for low mass, and then for high mass, the same initial stages, but they fuse hydrogen into helium. It takes a shorter amount of time, and they become a red supergiant. And then the core collapses and forms a supernova. And then if the core survives the explosion, depending on the mass again, can contract to become a neutron star, or if it's higher mass and it becomes a black hole. So star formation seems, I guess physics in general, seems very big and intimidating. And star formation and looking at space, some people, they always like, oh, that must be hard. But that's quite a simple overview. So I hope that inspires people to look more into it. You can definitely find more detailed explanations online. But that's a basic overview for you.
I hope now most of our listeners might be clear with the understanding of star formation. And we'll be bringing more and more episodes with more and more people, and we'll complete by the end of the season. You will be very clear with the understanding of stars, from the formation, death, life cycle, their types, and
great. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.